I think that if inflation is allowed to accelerate to a point where it becomes a clearly divisive political issue in moments like an election, then yeah, there is a choice between planning a recession and imposing a price freeze. Moving towards planning, I think, is the broader orientation. Indicative planning, a phrase that is often used to describe French macroeconomic policy in the 50s and 60s, and is how sort of the Kennedy-Johnson people consciously thought of what, you know, they were doing. And that, you know, that choice is rarely these days presented as such. You know, it's the idea is that if we're going to slow down the increase in prices, we're going to have to induce a recession. And I think the politics of that choice is a recipe for defeat. Like, if the responsible thing to do is going to throw working class people out of work, then it's no wonder you're going to lose the election. So part of the argument I'm making there is a political argument about political strategy, but it's also and more importantly, an argument about interpretations of history, where often journalists will say the experience and the memory and the history of American politics shows that if you allow inflation to happen, you're going to lose elections, and that the responsible thing to do is to not run, quote, run the economy so hot, end quote, you know, is not to have more ambitious reform programs. And I think it's worth pointing out that when the last liberal president was confronted with an accelerating inflation and chose this option of restraining his agenda, inducing a recession, he lost the election. Jimmy Carter was not reelected. You know, the Volcker shock and the Reagan recession cost him the White House. And so just in thinking about politics, you know, you should be honest about, you know, if the responsible thing is going to lose you, you know, the election and hand over power to a completely alternative agenda, maybe what you consider to be like the responsible thing is not so responsible after all.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
My name is Chris Hong. I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago Department of History, and I'm an intern at the Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Reviving Growth Keynesianism podcast. With all the talk of inflation and bottlenecks in the air, we thought it would be good to talk to one of America's foremost experts on the history of 20th century inflations, their causes, and various attempts to fight them. So today we're joined by Andrew Elrod, a writer and historian living in Los Angeles. He recently completed a dissertation on the history of wage and price controls in the US between 1940 and 1980 at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is now fighting the good fight as a union member of some kind. I'm not exactly sure. It's a new job. But Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Recently began work as a research specialist in a research department of a 36,000 member public sector labor union here in Southern California. But my heart and interests lie in academic research, as they've come to, and I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of my work here.
Well, great. So we're going to be talking about a set of your recent articles in Phenomenal World and the Boston Review on the politics of inflation. And you cover a lot of ground. They're a really rich set of texts. So we're going to see if we can get through it all today. But before we get to the articles themselves, I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into history and into this topic in particular.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I was raised in the 90s and, you know, Clinton and George W. Bush era. And I guess my parents were a little bit older. They had me later in life. So, you know, in my youth, there wasn't really a lot of, we didn't experience many dramatic fluctuations in the general price level at all. But the idea of inflation, you know, remained sort of lingering as the ultimate argument in any sort of grand debate about structural transformation. And that really stuck with me. I remember being, 18 years old and learning for the first time about the idea of a universal basic income, just as learning about policy as a teenager type of situation. And I remember thinking very distinctly, well, wouldn't this cause inflation? And just the fact that that was sort of the knee-jerk reaction, I think indicates sort of the underlying interest the topic presented to me. As far as how I got into it as a research area, and as the subject of my dissertation, there's two answers really. One is this sort of broader background. My mother was born and raised in Brazil and left during the dictatorship in the early 70s. But her, adolescence and early adult experience was dominated by the Brazilian inflation. And she would tell me stories about going to the store and seeing the prices for goods marked with a chalkboard or with a whiteboard of dry erase marker, because they had to be updated multiple times.
Trying to save on those menu costs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And for her, it was a profound experience of sort of dislocation. I mean, she left and at this point has spent more of her life in the United States than she did in Brazil, though all of her family remains there and we go back periodically. But you know, that was a clear example of the experience of inflation sort of shaping someone's life course, defining the political history of the sort of the high or hard dictatorship years. So, you know, that's on my mom's side. And then on my father's side, there was more of a general interest in the 1970s. You know, he was called for his physical for the draft in December of 72. You know, the Vietnam War was very much the defining experience of his late teenage and early adult years. Nixon, you know, Congress and Nixon's repeal of the draft in February of 73 meant that though he got the order to show up to the base, didn't, you know, it was never fulfilled. But, you know, the Vietnam War in the history of the 70s likewise was sort of a reference point for my, you know, sort of pre-college education about American history. And so those two, you know, that aspect of my background meant that I did have an interest in inflation, but I'd never really considered it as a research agenda until graduate school when I met somebody, Samir Santi, who is now a professor at CUNY in New York City. It was meeting him and reading him and talking with him that sort of got this project going. And wage and price controls, as the perspective on it, is this is, I argue, thoroughly in the mainstream of how the American government thought about stabilization for most of the 20th century. And it's only in our very recent history that has started to shift. So that's sort of we're going to get into this, I'm sure, but that's sort of the perspective that I brought to the project and sort of trying to figure out how that shift happened.
There's a really robust family background, but also a history that you're familiar with that has to do with mid-century debates about fighting inflation that you're seeking to recover and sort of bring back to public consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I should say about the Samir point, there's a political agenda. Mm. I mean, our interests, we came to graduate school as labor historians, in part, you know, interested in the problem of why the North American labor market has become so profoundly disorganized, you know, why union density has collapsed, why American workers have been unable to, or unwilling to take collective action as, you know, participants in the world of business. And in that political problem and historical problem is, you know, the shadow of inflation, the memory of inflation, and the argument that if you have an organized labor market, you have a sort of an inflationary environment. And so trying to actually figure out that argument, how to respond to that argument, what parts of that argument are empirically true, what parts are ideological, that was part of the project for us in graduate school that Samir really started and that I was very eager to participate in.
For listeners who may not sort of have much of a background in economics, but are still interested in historical political economy. Maybe it would be good to start off with just, you know, what is inflation? Because you argue that, you know, it's central to the professionalization of American modern macro in the post-war period, debates about inflation. What is it? Where does it come from? And you make this the case that it's, you know, it's not simple at all, right? Like there are different kinds of inflation that happens at different rates at different time periods. So what is inflation? At a very general level, what should we know about it?
Well, the term itself has the meaning behind the term itself has changed in the history of economic thought. And I think that point is worth exploring a little bit in Europe, on the continent, particularly in France, for much of the 19th century and Brazil, you know, in Latin nations through the 20th century, it referred to the money supply. And the idea was that the currency was what became inflated. And so the value of the currency would fall. That's an older meaning, but it persists through the history of economic thought in things like, equations that use price and velocity and number of transactions, money supply equations. Those attempt to put in algebraic terms relationships that deal with fluid dynamics, pressure, volume, temperature, in the late, well, really throughout the 19th century, that kind of physics became a sort of one framework for trying to understand money. But that's an older meaning. And part of what I've been trying to show is that, you know, what we think of today as inflation is not the money supply, but is the price level is measured through index numbers, which is a sort of later development in statistics, sort of 20th century, early 20th century development. And understanding what influences indexes of prices often has very little to do with anything that we can understand as the money supply. Without getting into whether you can even measure the money supply, I think conceptually it's worth distinguishing the two. So inflation, you know, has meant different things through the history of capitalism. And today, part of the confusion, I think, among journalists, among some academics, certainly within the public, part of the confusion is that there's this accumulation of different ideas that we're now, you know, it's a very familiar experience, you know, for those of us who have lived to the end of the 20th century to be confronted with this accumulation of symbols. But I think part of the task ahead, you know, should be to separate them out and actually figure out what we're talking about.
So in your piece, you make a distinction between general inflation and special inflation. And you make the case that economists have focused too much and too exclusively on general inflation. Can you explain what the distinction is and what we lose in over-specializing in the former?
Sure. What I'm talking about there, and for listeners, this is something that went up at Phenomenal World in January. So it's a little, I think it's relevant, but it's, it's from January. What I'm talking about there is the fact that people use inflation as to talk about specific prices. So we talk about healthcare inflation. We talk about, asset price inflation is a good example of this. The inflation is used to talk about price increases and price trends colloquially. And that's different from the older sort of 19th century understanding of the inflating the currency generally. And it's also different from the later sort of mid 20th century understanding of trying to control the general price level. And so, yeah, a big, I think, useful distinction people should make is between particular markets and the dynamics driving price trends in particular price and cost trends in particular markets and the general price level, which is what is lurking behind a lot of inflation alarmism, the idea that we're going to end up like Weimar Germany. And so to have an intelligent conversation, I think it's useful to step back and say, you know, what is it exactly that's going on now? What is it that, what are the particular prices that are increasing? And often you can tell that, in our recent history, oil has sort of dominated the general price level. So much of what we spend every day is gasoline or costs for goods that have to be shipped somewhere on trucks using gasoline. So I think as a preliminary move in any kind of discussion, you should distinguish what it is exactly you're talking about in terms of which prices are under the microscope, so to speak.
So maybe don't jump too quickly to high abstractions like the general price level and try to disaggregate into specific products and specific markets.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I also read your this article in particular as sort of making a perhaps more analytical intervention, right? Distinguishing on the level of analysis between evaluating general and specific inflation, but also you have an account that's much more rooted in the sort of history of US political economy and specific governments over the course of the post-war period. So maybe it'd be good to move next to get a handle on why there was this post-war almost liberal consensus on how to manage the economy that was more nuanced about the specific inflations that you mentioned in the article. So yeah, if you can maybe take us to the beginning of your account, what was the liberal consensus and how did it evolve in kind of concepts of inflation evolve alongside this history that you report?
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's a good question. It's a kind of, the answer is going to be a little complicated because what we usually think of as the post-war consensus, I have been arguing is a too narrow an understanding of the whole arsenal of sort of policy tools that were in the mainstream through the end of the 70s, really. But what we usually think of as, you know, the post-war liberal consensus is the incorporation of the ideas of John Maynard Keynes. So the idea of there being a total output that is an object of public policy that can be manipulated through something called, you know, aggregate demand, that can, you know, which can be manipulated by, you know, without taxes and spending, and that the difference between the federal revenues and federal expenditures in any year, any year can provide additional spending to, you know, to businesses or withdraw spending from businesses, and through that mechanism, adjust the total quantity of goods and services provided and through that employment. And a big part of debate, I would say the part of the reason that description of a post-war consensus is inadequate or incomplete is that people were very aware. I mean, during World War II, when this stuff first started entering the Bureau of Economic Analysis, it wasn't called that then, but, you know, the Commerce Department, the people who invented the national income and product accounts, which are the basis for things like GDP, which is the unit that for total output that you know, Keynes's ideas came to use, those using Keynes's ideas came to use. They were very aware that increasing spending might cause production to meet capacity in particular markets before other markets. So like in Keynesian theory, you know, you can spend money into the economy to raise output and employment. And so long as there's excess capacity, unused resources, unemployed workers out there, there's no theoretical reason for prices to rise. Now, what I'm saying is that people understood the difference between theory and reality. They experienced it in the mobilization for World War II and in the subsequent Korean War mobilizations, and very quickly understood that, you know, whatever, however clean the theory was in the general theory, there would have to be some adaptations made to the reality of mobilizing an economy to spend half of GDP on the military. So there's what historians and historians of economic thought have come to think of as the liberal post-war consensus, which is sort of Keynesianism. Then there's what I think is a more accurate understanding of the post-war consensus, which is sort of Keynesianism plus price controls. I mean, as evidence of the fact that this was in the mainstream, during the Korean War, we had wage and price controls. And during the Vietnam War, we had wage and price controls. To illustrate the depth of this sort of commitment to managing the economy this way, all you have to do is consider who Richard Nixon was and the world that he came out of sort of conservative business. Even Richard Nixon, when push came to shove, realized that to try and stabilize the economy, something that had been done, that he considered doing and that he did do, was freeze wages and prices. So I hope that's not too long-winded of an answer, but there's a post-war consensus that has been written about a lot. And then I think there's a sort of a different, more comprehensive understanding, which is something I've done some research on.
Yeah, I think that's really important to recognize, just the set of tools that they considered worth using or possible to use against this problem has really shifted. And I guess, could you talk a little bit about what the, you know, when they implemented, I mean, maybe in the 50s and 60s, when they put in these kinds of price controls, what did that look like? How was it received? How did it work? When did it work?
Sure. A typical history will say something like wage and price controls worked during World War II. There's a certain level of commitment and willingness to sacrifice among private individuals necessary for that to work, which existed in, you know, the global war against fascism, and that, you know, subsequently they didn't quote unquote work. And there is a lot of evidence that, I mean, during the Korean War, they were unpopular. I guess I should back up here and just sort of lay out the legal procedure for this sort of thing. To set a price ceiling, you know, you typically need an act of Congress. And then to police a price ceiling, you need a bureau or a commission, somewhere in the executive branch. And so during World War II, there were advisory price ceilings imposed before Pearl Harbor, but they were not effective because there was no penalty for anyone to, you know, against any producer, you know, and particularly the metals and the auto industry, and but also in farming. And, you know, people would sell their goods above the ceilings, and the commission in Washington would, you know, issue a letter saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. And that was that. And so there was inflation, and it took Pearl Harbor and the acceleration of inflation through December and the spring of 42 to bring Congress to pass a price control law with real teeth that, you know, effectively empowered the Office of Price Administration to control prices. Now that legal arrangement came with a schedule. So every June, every summer, price control authority would expire. The congressional appropriations that funded the salaries of the Office of Price Administration, the bureaucracy that monitored industry by industry cost price relationships, their budget would go up for renewal every summer. And many well-organized business groups learned that those hearings in the summer were a great opportunity to come and try and exempt themselves from some portion of the controls. So by the time the Korean War happens in the summer of 1950, you know, this is only 5 years after the end of World War II. And so that memory is very alive and well. It's become part of the regular bureaucratic practices of trade associations. So during the Korean War, you have two renewals, and they effectively exempt. I mean, they don't impose controls at the point of production for raw agricultural materials. So farm goods, cattle, meat, that's all out to begin with. They can raise prices as long as they want. They add a rule change that allows producers through what we would now call the supply chain to pass on cost increases. So the Korean War controls, you know, you might say they didn't quote unquote work in that it was a political fiasco. And part of the argument of my dissertation is that the memory of the Korean War then informed the decisions that the Johnson administration, or the indecision of the Johnson administration to impose controls during Vietnam. But the record, you know, the price record is that they stabilized prices in Korea. Korea didn't end with the type of decade of accelerating inflation that the Vietnam War ended with. So, you know, when people talk about whether or not price controls work, I think they're really simplifying a lot of you know, a sort of totalizing political economic discussion. You know, what are the criteria for success? You know, and that should be taken in consideration if we continue on this pattern of fiscal expansion, you know, and are forced to confront alternative anti-inflation policies.
Yeah, no, this is super helpful. I mean, I think just sort of giving a sense of what, you know, how we've dealt with inflation or how the government has dealt with inflation in the past and like how different an approach, I mean, it, like you've been saying, how different an approach that is to what we think of as being on the table right now is really useful.
Maybe a part of the story that we haven't touched on yet is the sort of institutional, I guess, conditions for something like price control or something like a coherent incomes policy to emerge out of this moment, which is the I guess strength of organized labor, right? That seems to be one big pillar of the post-war moment. And another seems to be government's willingness to tax profits or something like that, right? To sort of get both the capitalists and labor to agree on some kind of compromise restraint. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more maybe about the institution material kind of background to this moment of thinking about inflation.
Sure. The idea of taxing profits and particularly war profits, I think, is a very important part of understanding controlled mobilizations or controlled expansions. You know, what a price control bureau does is, you know, it surveils an industry or whatever is within its jurisdiction, measures costs and prices, both through, you know, requiring producers to file paperwork and also through its own examinations, you know, studies, surveys, and using cost information can try to determine, you know, where the marginal producers are, what the effect of a given price will be on the industry. And part, to do that effectively, you need to have some kind, or, you know, the government needs to have some kind of handle on the level of spending. So the excess profit taxes was a huge component of both the World War II and the Korean War mobilizations, where you would have the Department of Defense issuing these massive contracts, you know, to General Motors and Boeing. And Boeing and General Motors essentially setting their own prices and earning these huge windfall profits, which then could be spent on executive salaries, on wage increases, particularly if the industry had an organized labor market, or on investments, you know, depending on the moment, you know, the public might not, you know, want to spend resources on. And so taxing away excess profits was a huge part of siphoning purchasing power out of the system. I think this the type of language that would have been used back in the, you know, in the late 40s. I guess to push back maybe a little bit on your framing of a sort of organized capital labor accord, business in America was always against the excess profits tax. And it was such a sharply felt political issue that during the Vietnam War, there was no excess profits tax. And, you know, and it played so.
And that's because of the memory of the Korean War?
And I think also because of the political orientation of the Johnson administration, you know, the idea that in 1964, all of organized business lines up, you know, wall to wall against Goldwater for Johnson. Mm. The Kennedy-Johnson tax cut was a tax cut. You know, it was a tax cut. It was targeted towards capital formation. It had been preceded by a 10% investment credit. They included accelerated depreciation. It was a huge giveaway to large corporations. And so part of, you know, so there's the sort of political coalition aspect of it, which is that Johnson never felt himself willing to challenge that part of his coalition, ultimately to his demise, you know. But excess profits, I think, are you know, the idea of a excess profits tax should be part of any thorough consideration of how to sort of manage a boom. And they were parts, you know, the most successful examples of when we have sort of controlled inflation in this country came with such taxes on profits. Because in an expansion, particularly with the setup of our economy, profits are the first thing to grow. They grow rapidly fast, you know, and in part that's because of the way prices are set in so many markets. On the wage side, it's true that you do need some kind of collaboration or cooperation between people in the labor market with discretion over wages and the fiscal monetary authorities, you know, Washington, the CEA, the Treasury, whoever, you know, whatever committee and subcommittee in the Congress is making the decisions about fiscal policy. You know, during World War II and during the Korean War, as employment and production rapidly expands under government stimulus, the only way that workers were kept from going after the massive profits and using the power that they gained from tight labor markets to raise wages, the only way that is slowed down or prevented is by securing some kind of agreement from representatives of workers. And so you have to have, I mean, for workers to be represented, they have, you know, there has to be some kind of organization. In Europe, this type of cooperation, the left in Europe has often sort derided or historically, you know, associated this with fascism. You know, the Italian corporations, you know, labor brigades, any kind of, you know, group that claims to speak on behalf of workers, but is really in cahoots with the government, you know. And in the United States, in the American left, that perspective was, you know, alive and well into the 70s. You know, dissident caucuses and many unions were not excited at all about the prospect of cooperating with wage restraint with the Truman administration or with the Nixon administration. But just as a condition of how wage policies work, have worked, you know, you have to have an organized labor market. And we can get into, you know, the prospects for inflation in the future. But I think that understanding, you know, of how wages are set, you know, the fact that there are people there with power, discretion, you know, is a necessary, you know, fact to take into consideration.
Yeah, thanks. For the record, I didn't mean to what I think I used the word compromise, but I didn't mean like both parties were perfectly willing to enter into the. I was mostly referring to the coordination problem being controlling both capitalists and labor. But yeah, I mean, I think this is getting into your Boston Review piece, but you describe in 1952 where the Truman administration actually seize steel mills, right? Because to impose price controls basically on the steel industry in the face of recalcitrant capitalists. So yeah, I think that I didn't know about that, but that I think that goes to show that, you know, this was a very tension fraught kind of antagonistic move against the interests of capital.
Yeah, if you ever meet people who go to law school, which we all eventually do. You know, Youngstown Sheet and Tube is a famous case that is now taught, you know, is bearing on the question of executive power. But Youngstown Sheet and Tube was a steel company, and it was the first steel company named on this case that the industry brought against the Truman administration when, during the Korean War, to enforce wage price policy and ensure that the company did not pass on wage increases in the form of price increases and effectively to regulate steel industry profits. When to do all this, the Truman administration seized the industry, several hundred mills, and it went immediately to the Supreme Court, and the administration lost and the industry was returned. And the strike, to just give the whole story, the industry was seized to prevent a strike. And it was the failure in the courts of the seizure that led to the strike in 52. And the effect is akin to a recession of having the steel industry shut down. You know, hundreds of thousands of workers in downstream industries are then, you know, they can't, there's no material for them to do their job. So, you know, a steel strike, which happened periodically through the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s and into the early 70s, you know, is an example of the the kind of power that organized workers once had, and that was a precondition for the types of coordinated macroeconomic management that is the subject of the, a lot of the writing we're talking about today.
Wasn't there a big, I could be completely, I'm not an Americanist, I could be completely wrong about this, but wasn't there a big attack on, I guess this was maybe 1961 after the Bay of Pigs, wasn't there another big attack by the steel industry on, I think JFK, RFK, who tried to like impose some kind of price restraint on
You've heard Marilyn, Marilyn Monroe sing "Happy Birthday, Mr. President," right? It ASAP Rocky did that video with Lana Del Rey as a, for the younger listeners out there. You know, very famous moment, presidential history. "Happy Birthday, Mr. President." Part of the lyrics are, "When you took on U.S. Steel and our problems by the ton, you know, Happy Birthday, Mr. President." That's she's singing that weeks after. Roger Blau, the CEO of U.S. Steel, shows up to the White House to deliver the news that he is raising industry prices in violation of the Kennedy administration's voluntary price control program. They call them the price guideposts. Yeah, so steel remains a central industry to stabilization through the 60s, you know, with import penetration that begins, the political calculus begins to shift there. But in 1962, it's still, you know, Roger Blau can just walk into the White House, you know? So people don't teach that, but I think they should.
All right, so taking the story through the 60s, so you have these organized labor groups who are able to push up unit labor costs, who are asked to restrain wage increases. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. But the corporations want to keep their profit margins high, so they raise prices regardless, and they wind up sort of leapfrogging over one another, pushing up prices through the late 60s and into the 70s, right? Then the oil crisis hits, there's another sort of catastrophe. How does America's inflation nightmare end?
With a planned recession. You know, Jimmy Carter comes in January of 77, they have a brief experiment with a macroeconomic expansion. And they continue the program sort of voluntary price guidelines, but it, you know, price controls remain at the heart of this debate. Will Carter impose price controls? And, you know, you have the Brookings Institution as late as 79 and during the election, during the 80 election, is issuing reports that say, you know, we recognize this is the worst of all, you know, this is the worst, this is not what we'd like to advise. But stabilizing inflation right now might require some form of wage and price controls. So very what we think of as moderate centrist institutions understand that in a period of a runaway inflation, the public authority might have to impose a freeze. But Carter did not elect for controls. Instead, he appoints Paul Volcker to the Federal Reserve. An aspect of the decision that I think is often neglected in a lot of the contemporary writing about it is the concern in Washington for the global position of the dollar. You know, the decision to put Volcker in at the Federal Reserve is certainly motivated by concern over the price level at home, but it's equally motivated by the implications of inflation within the United States for the global monetary system. And it had been, throughout the 60s, inflation in the United States that forced the Nixon administration to end gold convertibility and to attempt to negotiate exchange rates through the 70s. And so the Volcker decision is a culmination of this global problem about uncertainty over the international monetary system. And so the final decision, or the initial decision, I guess, that launches us into the world we're in today, is to restore the global position of the dollar, to end inflation at home by raising interest rates to 20% for 3 or 4 years, and to wait it out. So, the worst recession since before World War II, the Volcker shock, you know, the bankrupting of several Latin American countries. You know, the world economy has to sort of adjust to a sustained period of 20% interest rates in the United States, where any kind of saver, or institutional investor, anyone who wants to earn a good return suddenly has a clear signal, this is the place to do it. And in the United States, everyone who borrows just dealing with it. And, you know,
and inflation does in fact come down.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Now, we never get out of what had been called creeping inflation, you know, the sort of 2% target that, you know, over the past 10 years has sort of dominated monetary policy discussion. That shift remains, but the kind of accelerating inflation in which a period of rising employment is associated with an increase in the annual rate of inflation, that ends, yeah, during the Reagan recession or the Volcker shock in the early 80s.
And so it seems to me like this sort of settles a lot of debates about what causes inflation, what the solutions are, right? That there's a huge debate in the 70s that you cover, like where inflation comes from. Is it unions? Is it administered prices? Is it commodities? Is it, it might be fiscal policy, it might be monetary policy. And Volcker just comes in and says, all right, this is what we're doing. Inflation comes down. The textbooks get totally rewritten. And this is what I was taught in graduate school. It's like, you know, Volcker was necessary to stop prices. And so every time, you know, inflation rears its ugly head today, this is sort of the only option that's ever even considered, right? Is like smashing the entire economy with monetary policy to stop price increases.
Yeah, there was a revolution in ideas. But I think it's worth also noting the relationship here between the world of ideas and real power. People like Adam Tooze and earlier William Grider, the journalist, you know, really made the point that in putting the national economy and American society through the grinding recession of the Volcker shock, the Federal Reserve effectively usurped power for itself, established a place for itself in Washington that it didn't have previously. And so the revolution in ideas that, you know, of course, this is a monetary phenomenon. This is the remit of monetary policy. Central bank staff are the people who we should look to when considering the price level. That revolution in ideas is related integrally to the actual revolution in power, where the Federal Reserve seized for itself the authority and responsibility to be the sort of the ultimate arbiter of how much expansion we can have.
Right. Everybody knows all the names of every central banker since Volcker, but can anyone name a central banker before Volcker? I don't think so. William McChesney Martin is not a household name. Maybe none of these guys are household names.
I've heard this line, what you're saying here, and those of us in the history departments always shake our heads whenever we hear that. It's true. Political scientists, economists, they don't have a clue of who William McChesney Martin was or Mariner Eccles.
Right.
But if you read any history of the New Deal, Mariner Eccles is a central figure. I mean, any good history of the
New Deal. Yeah, no, I'm talking about contemporary memory.
Right. Well, so, you know, historians as the keepers of, you know, of that historical knowledge maybe should be a little more vocal in informing contemporary memory there. You're right. Yeah. It's the Federal Reserve before Volcker, you know, is kind of a black box to a lot of people. And that makes it doubly weird that we have so much, you know, we place so much responsibility on it today.
So you're concerned in your second piece that we're going to talk about, the specter of inflation, about sort of this liberal instinct to turn to the Fed as the inflation problem solver. And you're sort of worried that people, that Biden is going to throw away his chances at more ambitious changes here, right? So the argument is that inflation just gives the general appearance that things are out of control. And when things are out of control, liberal journalists will argue, people want strong authoritarian responses. They want law and order. They want people who will restore discipline, you know, to workers who are quitting too often, who are demanding all these, you know, crazy price increases. But the type of control we need isn't, you know, monetary control. It's wage and price control.
That's an argument. And I think that if inflation is allowed to accelerate to a point where it becomes a clearly divisive political issue in moments like an election, then yeah, there is a choice between planning a recession and imposing a price freeze, moving towards planning, I think is the broader orientation, indicative planning, a phrase that is often used to describe French macroeconomic policy in the 50s and 60s, and is how sort of the Kennedy-Johnson people consciously thought of what, you know, they were doing. And that, you know, that choice is rarely these days presented as such. You know, it's the idea is that if we're going to slow down the increase in prices, we're going to have to induce a recession. And I think the politics of that choice is a recipe for defeat. Like it's very... It's, you know, if the responsible thing to do is going to throw working class people out of work, then it's no wonder you're going to lose the election. So part of the argument I'm making there is a political argument about political strategy, but it's also and more importantly, an argument about interpretations of history, where often journalists will say, you know, the reason the Great Society and the War on Poverty and liberal reform failed, which is a framing that is often used. You know, the reason Johnson, you know, bows out and the Democrats lose in 68 is inflation, and that the experience and the memory and the history of American politics shows that if you allow inflation to happen, you're going to lose elections, and that the responsible thing to do is to not run, quote, run the economy so hot, end quote. You know, is not to have more ambitious reform programs. And I think it's worth pointing out that when the last liberal president was confronted with an accelerating inflation and chose this option of restraining his agenda, inducing a recession, he lost the election. Jimmy Carter was not reelected. You know, the Volcker shock and the Reagan recession cost him the White House. And so just in thinking about politics, you know, you should be honest about, you know, if the responsible thing is going to lose you, you know, the election and hand over power to a completely alternative agenda, maybe what you consider to be like the responsible thing is not so responsible after all.
Right. So the responsible thing then is more planning, and planning that takes aim specifically at specific inflation rather than general inflation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
looking at bottlenecks, looking at sectors that are experiencing above average price increases like education or healthcare.
And doing so well before things get out of control. I mean, part of the conundrum historically in the United States after World War II is that there's never been adequately staffed planning agency in the executive branch. You know, in 46, they established the Council of Economic Advisors, which through the post-war period had a staff of around 60 people. The Office of Price Administration, which did these thorough studies of industry by industry cost price relationships, profit margins, you know, identifying marginal firms, calculating its own measures of unit costs, all the essential information you need to effectively plan an industry. It's like 100,000 people in the 40s, you know? So like you need a big office. I think it was 75,000 people, but you know, it's in terms of orders of magnitude, totally different than the Council of Economic Advisors, 60 people, you know, measuring what the output gap might be. You know,
it's an employment program in its own right.
Yeah. And you know, in 1942, a lot of those staff would have been doing things that we now do on computers. So you know, I'm not trying to put any serious numbers out there for people considering how to set up a planning agency today. But the point I'm making is that in the absence of such a standby, you know, standing authority to produce the information about where bottlenecks exist today or may exist in 2 or 3 years, without that authority, the only way we know is through experience is when we come up, you know, we live through a business cycle upswing and then the bottlenecks appear. And at that point, it's almost too late because then inflation starts to get out of control. And, you know, in July of 1965, when Lyndon Johnson decides to increase the American troop presence in Vietnam, this happens. And by the next summer, which is during the campaign for the midterms, inflation appears to many people to be out of control. And so to prevent governments from getting into the situation, you know, the lesson of the 20th century, at least for the capitalist countries, is that prior planning needs to be in place before you embark on the expansion, you know, I don't mean planning in terms of like issuing orders, like command and control or whatever. I just mean gathering information. Like you need to know what industry is capable of doing now before you spend money into the economy to try and raise employment.
It's such a blind spot when you stop and think about it. I think that this is, you know, this is one thing that I take from both this piece and the specific and general one is that, you know, as you've been saying, like the idea, you know, where do price increases come from? It's like, if there actually are specific supply bottlenecks, then like the solution there is not to, crash the economy. It's to like expand production or it's to, you know, rethink how we're providing healthcare or whatever. And like, I think that that's I feel like I'm maybe starting to see this framing a little bit out in the sort of public discussion, especially about this current wave of inflation, where it's so clearly tied to, or seems to be so clearly tied to COVID-related supply issues, at least in part. But it does seem like that could be a bit of a shift from how it's been thought of in the past as being just about the total, the amount of like hydraulic pressure on the money supply or something like that.
It's been a tremendous shift in thinking. I mean, in the world of like little magazines and
our world.
Right. Right.
And little podcasts.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how long it can last. You know, I think part of the political space that has opened up, that allows people to say government spending, reduces inflation, which is just like 180 degrees from 5 years ago. Part of that political space is opened because of the demobilization and weakness of the working class and of reform, what some might call a liberal reform program. In past inflations, particularly during the Vietnam War, government spending was accompanied almost immediately by coordinated wage increases, you know, sector by sector, in bargaining on behalf of hundreds of thousands of workers and strikes to win those. But today, you know, we have 10,000 workers at John Deere, you know, little groups of 1,000 workers here and there. And that is seen as some kind of like, you know, storming of the Winter Palace, or, you know, it's a minuscule time, you know, none of those strikes are going to change industry wage patterns. Like they're going to, like if they win and, you know, God willing, you know, they'll change wage policies at those firms, but like the economy is not organized today to have wages determined in the way that it was 50 years ago. And because of that, there is space for discussion of expansionary fiscal policy, targeted investments, bottleneck expansion, this sort of thing. Because we're not seeing the wage explosion that happened in the late 60s. And, you know, those at the bottom of the labor market today are seeing, you know, well-deserved increases, but the whole, you know, it's not the wage explosion that people like Arthur Burns in the late 60s were, you know, waving their hands about.
So in addition to this, like, general specific distinction, there's also a temporal distinction, right, between the kind of national industrial economy that we had during the mid-century passage and the more service-oriented globalized economy today. That means inflation just works totally differently. So that conceptual tools like, you know, the quantity theory money or the Phillips curve, whatever, however well they might have worked during the mid-century passage, or however much they might have been an expression of the inability of, you know, corporate liberalism to develop a more robust planning politics, they just don't work today.
It's a different institutional setup. Yeah, just to bring this back to your original question, general inflation, you know, what we typically think of as inflation, has been propelled by increasing incomes among the entire population, specifically increasing incomes among workers. What we think of today as general inflation in the 30s and 40s was described with the phrase wage price spiral. And today, prices are going up, but there's not the spiral's not turning because the wages aren't, you know, we're not having wages leapfrog to try and reestablish some kind of real income. We're just seeing a huge explosion of profits today. And it shows up like if you look at the national income accounts, like the profit share of national income has risen during the reopening. And this labor shortage stuff is real and wages at the bottom are rising, but it's not the kind of turning wage price spiral that characterized the inflation of the late 40s or the inflation of the late 60s?
I guess this is maybe getting away at maybe the meat and bones of the papers, but I'd be curious to get, because I felt like I didn't get a perfect read on whether or not wage spiral inflations are just permanently relegated to a thing of the past, or if, you know, normatively we even want to go back to that kind of economy. I guess I you know, you hear this line about people, not nominally progressive folks, talking about, you know, industrial policy or something, like this kind of yearning for incomes policies or back to this era where the wage price spiral inflation paradigm would be actually in play again. So yeah, like do you view that period as sort of in any kind of normative way? Like was it like is it something that we should try to return to, I guess is what I'm saying. Vis-a-vis industrial policy or whatever other kinds of repatriating, you know, industry or labor, blue collar labor especially.
Well, I'm certainly not saying the world of the 60s is something we should try to recreate, but I do think it's worth considering that to do incomes policies, you have to have some control over incomes, and that today, you know, in a world in which inequality is sort of the totalizing political problem, you know, across social spaces, across academic disciplines, you know, and given the salience of inequality today, you know, the idea of controlling incomes is something that is going to come up in any variety of discussions. So the history of the 20th century, of macroeconomic management in the 20th century, is one in which the public, through its government, acquired some control over incomes. The Social Security, SSI, various programs through the Social Security, healthcare, you know, Medicaid, Medicare. There are various types of income that have come under federal control. And likewise, taxes, you know, so much of property income is effectively determined by tax rates, you know. So I guess what I'm pointing out is that if we want to try and control the economy again, it's worth considering a moment of history where we had some semblance of control at all. Because today it seems so, you know, the discussion is so much more limited, and often it seems like we don't actually know how to control the economy.
All right. So if the future of inflation policy for the left is an advance towards planning, what does that look like? What would it mean to start planning, for example, in the construction industry?
It's a good question. Maybe I should step back. Well before the coronavirus pandemic and reopening boom, or whatever we want to call this, and the idea of a labor shortage entered the news, there had been several industries where the phrase labor shortage was used, you know, industry associations, business conferences, where you know, retention, recruitment was a theme for sort of people, you know, running these industries. Public education is one of them. You know, there's a shortage of elementary school teachers. That's something you hear in a lot of states. There's a teacher shortage, and you heard that before the pandemic. Now you hear it even more emphatically. Another one of those industries is construction. So one project I did recently was to look through, talk with people in the construction industry about this idea. And what I found is that the industry is very divided. I mean, first of all, there's no like one national construction industry. Any construction market is usually based around a big city. It's based around the few firms that own the big cranes and machines, you know. But even among, if you compare all these different construction markets, there's a clear distinction between types of construction markets, which are unionized, and those which are not. And, you know, wages in the union side are about twice or three times as much, if you include retirement and healthcare and everything, much more expensive labor in the union side. And the firms often, you know, legally, there's a big difference in the fact that it's actually employment relationships that are covered by all the various laws that apply to employment relationships. Who pays the Social Security taxes, the Medicaid, Medicare taxes, who pays the workers' comp insurance, that sort of stuff. And these markets are concentrated generally in the northeastern cities, New York metro area, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Chicago is a big one, Pittsburgh. You know, these are the markets, construction markets, where if you're going to build a building, you're going to sign a contract with the union, or you're going to hire a contractor.
What's good for you?
And Los Angeles on the West Coast, you can add those in. So sort of the Northeastern, Upper Midwest, I think, well, also St. Louis, you know, Northeastern, Midwest, big metropolitan urban centers, plus the West Coast. But there's a whole other set of cities, Phoenix, Dallas, Houston, Miami, across the South and West, what we know as the Sun Belt, where if you're going to build a building, you're going to hire a contractor that's probably not going to be using union labor. And it's those companies, those contractors, and particularly the construction users, the developers, the banks behind them, in those marketplaces, which for a decade before the coronavirus pandemic, were complaining about a labor shortage. And so trying to understand this distinction between—
Wait. So I just want to flag that. So that's wild. So the unionized part of the country has as many construction workers as it needs. The non-unionized part of the country can't find the workers they need.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I had the same reaction.
That's an insane paradox that's totally unexpected.
Right.
So why is that? In free market, why can't they just raise wages and, you know, hire more workers?
Often they do. And if you look at wage fluctuations, you look at regional wage statistics by the BLS, when you have a tight labor market in Houston, you're going to see a bigger jump than in Los Angeles. But that's the reason it becomes such an acute political issue worth all this lobbying. Because if you're in a labor short market, you know, a tight construction labor market, and you're forced to raise wages, because that's the only way you're going to get your project done, that's going to impact your bottom line. You know, the thing to understand about construction is that it's highly competitive. Getting a team of people together to particularly in the non-union construction where there's very little accreditation or anything, getting a team of people together to do some carpentry, drywalling, and, you know, manual labor, there's a low barrier to entry. A lot of people can do that. And so pricing becomes competitive. And so if you're in a tight labor market in a non-union construction city, and you're forced to raise wages because you're in a building boom, suddenly you're a contractor, you know, bringing home maybe $100,000 a year or whatever, you know, you got a 20, 40 guys who come to you regularly for work. Suddenly your income is, you're personally experiencing a squeeze on your income. And so that's why the non-union construction company lobby is so concerned about the idea of labor shortage, because they feel it. They really feel it. So I've been trying to understand, you know, why this is, I started talking to some people in the building trades and reading the publications put out by the Associated Builders and Contractors and the General Contractors of America, you know, these employer side associations. And what I realized is that very people understand how training works in construction, but a building trades contract, you know, say in the city of Chicago, includes an employer contribution to an apprenticeship fund. So every time a building goes up in New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles, a big building, talking downtown, you know, 20 story skyscraper, part of the cost of that building is employer contributions to a training fund, which then pays the salary of apprentice carpenters and apprentice metal workers and apprentice operating engineers learning how to drive these machines, you know, apprentice plumbers. And if you're going to work as a career construction worker, you're going to, you know, the condition to doing so is going through an apprenticeship program. And so every year, the leaders of the several building trades in a city will meet with some representatives of the major contractors and say, you know, what's the plan for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years? How many apprentices do we need now so that we can have enough carpenters and metal workers in 2 years? And they plan the industry. That's the way they do it.
Unions are involved in the planning?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. They come together. I mean, they have to negotiate the rates that the company's going to pay for apprentices. So,
and is that under the aegis then of like local government, city government, state government, or is that what's this?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a great question. And it's going to seem foreign to a lot of listeners from the United States. It's private. There's most cities have a building and trades council, which is, you know, the it's usually attached in some way to the Central Labor Council, which are the municipal lobbying arms of the AFL-CIO, which is the national federation, the largest national federation for labor organizations in the United States. But they have regional councils for each market in which they invite the employers who they're doing business with. You know, I mean, they have to negotiate with them, because when you get a new entrant who, you know, is going to do some entrepreneurial activity and try to maybe put up a building without signing a contract and not paying into the apprenticeship fund, then you have to coerce them into signing a contract with you. But given the nature of collective bargaining and the way unions come to control labor markets, there, you know, the forum emerges organically for having these types of discussions about, you know, rates, rates for apprenticeships, numbers of apprenticeships, salary for, you know, pay, hourly rates for the workers themselves. And so the body that does that is usually some kind of regional joint council of the union leaders, and then they'll meet with representatives of the contractors. There's two major employer side organizations in the United States. There's the General Contractors of America, which has historically been composed of firms that sign union contracts, unionized firms, but today is maybe about half and half. And then there's the Associated Builders and Contractors, ABC, which before the 70s was not a real national presence. But during the 70s, a lot of the major multinational corporations in the United States, DuPont, Union Carbide, major construction users, people putting up factories, buildings, they began steering business to the ABC, which had been primarily, you know, small firms across the South, but the Sun Belt, you know, to go back to the original distinction. And so today the ABC is smaller than the General Contractors of America, but it is comparable and very politically motivated as an anti-union organization. So they go to the Department of Labor and regularly lobby to weaken prevailing wage laws. They fight any kind of law or regulation that's going to strengthen organized labor. Most recently with this stuff, you know, the various laws that the administration is trying to get through Congress, the ABC has been on the forefront of saying, and in the courts on the forefront of saying, any kind of liberalization of organizing law, or depending on how you look at it, any kind of strengthening of organizing law, you know, the PRO Act was the AFL-CIO proposal. ABC is one of the organizations leading the fight against the PRO Act.
Yeah, that's a lot of great detail on the built trades. But just so we don't get lost, how I understand the overall argument to be going is that the labor shortage complaint that's coming from the non-union construction sector it doesn't really have anything to do with, you know, overall excess demand or something like that. It's because the non-union construction sector lacks the sort of training infrastructure and hence the capacity to plan long-term to relieve these like almost supply bottlenecks of skilled labor or skilled enough labor that sort of perpetuating their labor shortage problem or something like that. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I should clarify that despite industry claims that they can't find enough skilled labor, the buildings are going up. Like building hasn't stopped. The complaint is that because labor is not ready and available at current wages, they have to raise wages, and that they can't operate the industry in the way that they'd like to, sort of with unilateral control over their own income, over the wages they pay to other people, you know. And that's the context in which the complaint of a labor shortage emerges. There's not any shortage of labor. there are day labor markets in many cities where people go to a Home Depot somewhere and wait to be picked up for hourly rates. If there's something that there's a lot of in America, it's labor. But the framing of the particular business problems in terms of the labor shortage, I think reveals a real underlying problem, which is training, apprenticeship, you know, how to incorporate a relatively homogenous product of day labor, you know, of labor, into going concern, where you're going to be doing particular tasks. You know, you need to be on call. In the unionized markets, they've figured it out. It just means the employers have ceded a lot of control over the industry. And so there's that underlying question of who controls the industry that's laying behind the problem of a so-called labor shortage.
What are the proposed solutions coming from the non-union sectors for the problem? Like, are they pushing like vocational schooling or something like that?
Yeah, they want to try and replicate apprenticeship programs, which in union markets are paid for by employers. They want to replicate it through the public sector. So to have government
socializing finance, the costs.
Exactly. Yeah. Socializing the costs. You get the community colleges to offer trade schools. You know, it's not, but there's nowhere where it's been, where it's been scaled. You know, it's not, it hasn't, you know.
Is that a plausible solution then?
I don't know. It's certainly politically palpable. You know, the idea of expanding community colleges has long been the sort of political meeting point between the, you know, left wing of the, or whatever, the center of the Democratic Party and the Republicans. They can agree that, you know, they're going to disagree on whether or not there should be, you know, universal access to higher education and like college degrees. Like, that's going to be a huge political disagreement. But expanding trade schools and vocational education seems like something that could get through. I'm not assiduously tracking Congress anymore, but it always seemed like the sort of conservative Democrat position.
Because in the end, that doesn't wind up empowering labor. Labor still has to go through these kind of, they have to go through the state in order to get to the capitalists. And at right. No point do they have control over the conditions of their own work or their own sort of social reproduction.
Right. Yeah. The idea there is that it's not going to, that wages won't have to change. The supply of labor existing wages will be more highly skilled. And so the calculus, what you're saying makes sense. Whereas the solution offered by organized labor is that, well, you know, we have to have a say, we have to negotiate together, you know, how the industry is going to be run, what our share of the industry revenues are going to be, and we'll supply you labor that we train, but on the basis of that underlying agreement. That's a harder sell if you have lived your whole life in a market where the employers sort of have unilateral power and discretion.
So one other aspect of this article that I found really fascinating was the sort of, I guess, the way in which it seems like the construction sector pioneered a lot of what we now think of as the gig economy, where, you know, going back a couple of decades even, you know, this was something where the employment relations were breaking down and, you know, things that have now started to happen elsewhere were already happening. Could you walk us through a little bit about how that unfolded?
Sure. The Mark Ehrlich, who is now a fellow at the Harvard Work-Life Program, but before that was a career business agent for the Carpenters in New England, is the sort of authority on this stuff. And a lot of what I wrote came out of his scholarship. But the claim there is that independent contracting, and it's true, you know, the shifting of large parts of a payroll, you know, from an employment relationship covered by, you know, the Fair Labor Standards Act, to independent contractor relationship was pioneered in Sunbelt construction firms, where they learned not only that you could save a lot on taxes, you don't have to pay the Medicare, Medicaid portions that you normally have to pay as the employer contribution to these social insurance programs, but you could also shift workmen's comp. You know, a lot of you could shift that on to the workers themselves. They would be responsible for deciding whether or not they participate in any kind of private insurance, and that wages themselves entered into, you know, the wages became a market price that was outside of the Fair Labor Standards Act's floors. You know, if it's not an employee, if the worker is not an employee, then the employment laws don't apply. If the worker is an independent contractor rendering a service, then you can introduce a lot of competition and drive down the price of that service to however low you can. And that is something that the non-union firms really pioneered in the 70s, which the Treasury Department and the Carter administration, you know, sort of facilitated in allowing to classify workers this way. So Ehrlich sort of did the research there, and I took it and he, I mean, he's the one who used the news peg of, like, you know, in California and New York, where state legislatures are debating these laws about whether or not to begin to reapply employment laws to these app companies, which provide labor on a purely independent contractor basis. You know, he's the one who said, well, you know, this is not a new debate. They've been debating this in construction for 30 years, you know? And so he's really the guy to go to with any of those questions. But yeah, people don't realize that it's not unique to Uber and Lyft and Postmates. It's pervasive. David Weil, the Brandeis economist and Obama, and now assuming the Congress, you know, approves his appointment, Biden, director of the Wage and Hour Division in the Department of Labor, David Weil is the other authority on this. He's done a ton of, you know, he wrote the book on wage determination and independent contracting called The Fissured Workplace, in which he shows that, that, you know, there's a clear incentive for companies to alter their labor practices in this way to shift employment into independent contracting, not only in terms of their labor costs, but also in terms of financing. Like, the stock of a company that begins to sell off constituent departments and begin fissuring, you know, the way Weil looks at this is fissuring the workplace, their stock prices go up immediately. Like, the markets love it. You know, they know that it's probably a harbinger of some good profits in the future. You know, so there's a ton of pre-existing research sort of on the fissured workplace, Ehrlich stuff on construction, and I was just bringing it to the attention, you know, the audience, just reminding people, you know, this is still there's a basic debate here in the United States about what does and doesn't come under employment law, and a lot of what we think of as innovation is essentially selling labor outside of employment law.
All right, so we've got a few different ways of thinking about how to counteract inflation then. All right, so we've got the sort of Office of Price Administration model. We've got the kind of, like, public investment in bottlenecks model. We've got sort of organized labor helping to spontaneously plan around future bottlenecks model. Yeah, so there are a lot of options that aren't monetary policy.
I would say that there's one thing you didn't include, although is kind of implied by, you know, organized labor helping to plan around bottlenecks, was the Kennedy-Johnson wage price guideposts, which, you know, unlike OPA, did not entail its own standing independent bureaucracy, but which attempted, you know, a similar task of tracking unit costs by industry and identifying when price increases were occurring in industries where unit costs were falling, and using that to make a claim that certain price increases were not justified or are in violation of what they called the price guidepost. Now, the reason I bring that up is that kind of voluntary advisory form of price guidance didn't work. As soon as the Vietnam War spending,
hence why it's not on the list, Andrew.
but I think there's a political lesson there. The Johnson administration made a strong appeal to the leaders of organized labor during the Vietnam War to restrain wage increases, and with collective bargaining, there's a very clear opportunity for the government to try and influence unions, because there's a moment when the decision is being made. Bargaining is happening. A strike is going on. There's a decision to be made. Corporate pricing is not always so out in the open. And so it was the vision or the experience, I should say, the experience of organized workers during the Vietnam War, that their real wages, which were adhering to the guidelines, it was the experience that their real wages were falling because corporate prices were not adhering to the price guidelines, that motivated the wage explosion and led to a situation in which neither the Johnson nor the Nixon administration could stabilize the labor market. And only, you know, the brief period of price control, you know, began to move towards stability and was quickly undermined by the oil shock, the Watergate, you know, and so in living memory, the last real strike wave is 1970, between 70 and 74. You know, it's this period when people very clearly expressed dissatisfaction at a government they considered to be unjust, if not illegitimate. You know, and so what I'm saying is here, the voluntary stabilization program can be more effective in certain parts of the organized economy than others. And the fate of a elected government will hinge on, you know, who does and doesn't feel like their cooperation was, you know, worth it. But I think, you know, the reason I bring up the Kennedy-Johnson guideposts is to say that, you know, short of control, price control, there are a variety of types of guidance, voluntary guidance that can be issued, has been issued. To rest a sort of stabilization program on that opens up its own political problems. People often say price control opens up all these political problems in the Congress, getting the law through, but not having price control likewise, you know, opens up political problems.
I'm just sort of curious, with the guideposts, was there any like data collection apparatus then that is no longer around, or is that something that you could, like, could one go out and figure out, you know, which products today are, you know, have price gouging going on or whatever?
Yeah. So part of the archival research I did was through the records of the ad hoc anti-inflation task force in the Johnson White House. And even without going to the archives, you can read in the memoirs of the White House staff what a huge problem this became. The way they set it up was Joseph Califano, who was President Johnson's personal assistant, became the liaison between an ad hoc team of two independent, you know, staff brought on for the purpose, plus CEA, who would then have a weekly meeting and say, like, where should we be looking for, you know, wage or price decisions that we should be aware of, and which, you know, as, you know, through 66, 67, and 68, as inflation accelerated, those meetings became increasingly untenable. And so in his memoirs, Joe Califano talks about it as the Dutch boy putting his finger in the dam, you know, in the dike, and saying like this, you know, but by 1968, there were more holes in the dike than fingers, you know. And the lesson he drew, you know, he would go on to serve as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in the Carter administration. So there's another example of where sort of learning happens. The lesson he drew was that this kind of informal stuff was never going to work, because if you had a truly robust expansion, everyone's going to be trying to raise wages and prices. There's going to be a lot of demand. People are, and a little informal group of three guys sitting around a table with ad hoc staff, no dedicated staff, is not, you know, it's going to be inadequate. So that's the way they did it. Today, you could use, the FTC puts out quarterly financial reports, and you could use that to try and measure margins and maybe have some kind of measure of cost per unit, per industry or whatever. For it to be meaningful, you know, you'd have to have a comprehensive, you know, it should probably be in the government where this is being done. I think it's worth pointing out that those quarterly financial reports that the FTC requires were not always, they didn't originate in the FTC. In 1946, when the congressional appropriation for OPA was expired, and World War II price controls ended, the staff work and bureaucratic responsibility for those reports was transferred to FTC. So like the record, the actual administrative process is an inheritance of World War II price controls. And the only reason FTC has those quarterly reports is because OPA required it during the war.
Huh. So OPA lives in some ghostly form still.
It's yeah. Yes. And wow. Thank God, because those reports have very important information.
Yeah, I guess this is the politics of data destruction.
Right, right.
What kind of data gets collected and which is just deemed the remit of the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Too dangerous to have the public know about.
Yeah, how much profits I'm making.
Right.
I mean, so like in these memoirs, these kind of ad hoc administrators, they're basically seeing in real time the wage price spiral happening, right?
Yeah.
The fact that it's really rising untaxed corporate profits that are disintegrating the sort of bargain, I guess you can call it. And forcing labor to then feel that their real wages are going down and sort of retaliating kind of in response. Yeah, I don't know. Do they ever get like frustrated at, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah. If you read through the speeches, Gardner Ackley, who is the chairman of Johnson CEA, Dusenberry, who was after him, who writes the Politics of Prosperity? Oaken, Arthur Oaken, Califano, who is not an economist, who's a lawyer, but who is sort of in charge of these people. Yes, it's characterized by an intense frustration. I would say, though, that part of the trend of the 60s, certainly intellectual trend, was not to express frustration against the corporations and say that, and to use the language you used of corporate profits, which force labor to sort of go after higher wage increases. In fact, it's the opposite. And I think this is part of the sort of the legacy of the Cold War and the civil rights movement, really, because a lot of these unions, and particularly the building trades, were racist, exclusionary unions. They would not give apprenticeships to people of color. But given that setup, the experience of the wage price spiral in the late 60s to somebody like, Gardner Ackley or Arthur Oaken was, why can't the unions cooperate? Why won't organized labor acquiesce into the expansion? Wages outside of organized labor are going up. Black women service workers are seeing real income increases. So why doesn't Walter Reuther at the auto workers, or why don't the steel workers just tolerate some corporate profit increases? Because this is helping us equalize, it's helping us bring the bottom of the labor market up. And that political, that distinction and political point of view between labor leaders and liberal bureaucrats in the late 1960s is part of why liberalism falls apart, why Nixon is elected, and I don't mean to be saying bureaucrat in a pejorative sense. I mean, administrators, so today, who knows what would happen today, but in the 60s, that's part of the, Alan Mattuso has a great history of the 60s called The Unraveling of America. That's part of the unraveling.
I feel like you just introduced a whole new set of like extremely rich themes around race and gender and the Cold War that we could just spend another,
well, maybe you should move that up.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually thinking, at some point we should read your dissertation and discuss all of this in much more depth.
I would, if you're honest, I'll send it to you. It's 600 pages. So
100%. Yeah, yeah. Wait, did you say 700 pages?
Six.
Okay.
Double space.
Well, then that's reasonable.
Yeah.
If it was 700, that'd be too much. But. Yeah. Okay. So we're nearing the end of an extremely long interview already, and you've been so generous with your time. I just want to close by asking if you have any sort of general thoughts about the future of inflation in the near or the long term. Because one of the things that I'm thinking a lot about right now is the Charles Goodhart book on the Great Demographic Reversal. And he essentially argues that the last 40 years have been characterized by, China entering the global labor market, East Europe entering the global labor market,
boomers and women entering the global labor market, and that this just, you know, this massive increase in the supply of labor has eroded labor's bargaining power. But that going forward, we're running out of Chinese peasants, of Polish workers who are willing to be exploited by Germany, of boomers, you know, and that that what's coming is a great demographic reversal, which will put labor back in a very strong bargaining position in the next 50, 60 years. And that an implication of that will be a reversal of the deflationary regime of the past 40 years. So that we will be, in fact, dealing with these issues for a long time to come. Obviously, that's like a very, very specific kind of like population-based argument. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you have any general thoughts about sort of the contemporary and future, near future politics of inflation?
Well, I think the type of demographic, secular, structural argument that Goodhart lays out and that you see it in a lot of other places, is useful, but in some ways apolitical. It's one in which decisions like decisions don't really matter. And so if we're thinking about elections, which increasingly I am, you know, that kind of background is important, and can even be used in making sort of electoral appeals, but may not be as immediately important to the types of short-term changes that may accompany the upturn of however many cycles we experience in the next 50 years, you know? And I think that the analysis, at least in terms of American politics, needs to be shortened to particular business cycles rather than, you know, it's important. You should never lose sight of whatever the long-term trend is. Don't get me wrong. But for discussing inflation,
being the answer to that, but we're not there yet.
I can neither confirm nor deny my participation in this podcast. Inflation in the short term today, I think it's important to think about where rising wages are going to be expressed through prices. So I do think, like restaurants, for example, like the public is going to have to accustom themselves to hire food away from home. Like the restaurant industry runs on dirt cheap labor. And if the trends that we're seeing of wages at the bottom increasing continue, restaurants, which have the very thin profit margin, a very competitive industry, you know, you go to wherever the cheap food is, they, you know, those prices are going to rise. And that's a sort of thing that, like, I think often consumers should take into consideration, you know, whether or not the price increases they're seeing are driven by what some might say sort of necessary changes to those industries or by something else. I mean, pharmaceuticals is a totally different story. You know, pharmaceuticals are seeing, you know, 20% and up returns, you know, this year and before, you know, on varieties of product lines that would have just these tremendous windfall profit rates that you don't see anywhere else, and high prices. And that's a situation in which you could make a sort of political case that maybe those prices should not be so high. I guess, you know, the politics of inflation in the short term, I would say, are going to depend a lot on the next, 6 months or... I think the Congress's willingness to underwrite a fiscal expansion is not in any kind of certainty, you know. And since CARES 2 or whatever, for most of 2021, despite, you know, whatever temporary bottlenecks and persistent talk of labor shortage, if anything, seems like there's a kind of shortfall of demand. Like there's still 8 million people unemployed, you know. So I think the question going forward is going to depend on whether the administration and the Congress can sort of make a commitment to growth or not. And if they do, then that's going to open up a whole variety of interesting questions. But they may not. And you know, the lesson of the Obama years certainly was that they couldn't, you know. So we're going to see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Andrew. And we're looking forward to having you back on at some point in the future. Good luck with all of your organizing and campaigning.
Nick, it's my pleasure.
It's good to know that somebody with this kind of erudition is on the front lines.
Chris and Robert, it's nice to meet you both.
Nicholas, it's great.
Thanks for having me.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.